Our third speaker is Mary Elizabeth Rule. She has a BS in French from Georgetown University and a PhD in American Civilization from the University of Pennsylvania. She is currently academic archivist and head of special collections at the Air Force Academy. She was archivist at the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum from 1984 to 1988 and has worked at the National Archives and Records Administration in the Nixon Presidential Materials Project and at the Smithsonian Institution Museum of Natural History in the National Anthropological Archives. It's nice to see Mary Elizabeth, a friend of mine.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm going to be talking about 1971 through 1974, when I did not live here. I started out in 1984 at the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum, and people always said, oh, are you a native? Are you a pioneer? And I would have to say, no, I'm from Philadelphia, just like Spencer Penrose and General Palmer. And so my talk really segues very well into, or after Bill Saltzman's talk, because I am starting in 1971. I was a college student in 1969. I remember that time. I had a lot of friends who were trying to decide whether they were going to be drafted or go into the Peace Corps or go to graduate school. And it was a very difficult time. And in 1970, with Kent State and the killing of four protesters, you really had kind of a shocked reaction to what was going on. And I think Richard Nixon definitely was aware of the changes in people's feelings in the country. By 1973, you had the end of the draft, basically the war in Vietnam was winding down, and then in 1975, you had the fall of Saigon. I'm going to speak mainly in terms of General Clark, who was the superintendent of the Air Force Academy from 1970 through 1974. I did an oral history interview with General Clark in 2005, and it's at the Pikes Peak Library District. It was part of a project that we had. There were a group of us, Jim Ferfari was just here, Judy Finley, people like that, who were trying to document community relations and what was going on in Colorado Springs around basically following up to Newport of the Rockies, which ends somewhere around 1980. And so one of the things that I asked him in the oral history was what happened during the Vietnam War when there were protesters and people who would come out to the academy and camp out by the chapel. And General Clark said, yes, we had a difficult time with people who were opposed to the war. It was a very fashionable and ardent group who battered us for some time. Initially, it was very bad because they intruded during services on Sunday and would cause all kinds of confusion, interrupting the service, including having to be bodily hauled out. But eventually, it became clear that it was illegal to interrupt activities. They could visit us and distribute their literature and so on outside in places that were roped off, but they were not allowed inside. That became a legal decision that helped us for a great deal. I'll talk about that a little bit later. This is General Clark on the right. He came to the academy in 1970. He was supposed to retire, and he was at Air University as the head of that, and he knew that coming to Colorado Springs was not going to be the easiest thing for him. He had lived in Colorado Springs in the 1950s when he was at Ent Air Force Base, which we've already talked about, and he really loved the city, and he really wanted to come and be superintendent. He knew the community pretty well. I have pictures of people like Joe Reich giving him a Boy Scout award. Here he is with Jasper Ackerman, who was one of the business leaders. He was a range rider. He had his own horse. He went. He was invited to dinners at the El Paso Club. But as Will Schultz so well pointed out, the chapel was an icon in Colorado Springs. It was something that everybody was familiar with. It became a rallying point for people who wanted to demonstrate against the war. There were three chapel-faced areas, so I won't go into that because Will covered that as well. And I'm going to read from a congressional inquiry response to Senator Warren Magnuson. This was written in 1972 and talks about kind of the beginning of what was going on at the Air Force Academy. On the first real demonstration that I could find was on the 15th of May, 1971. An organization identified as Spring Against the War, a subsidiary of the Colorado Peace Coalition, engaged in protest activities at the Academy. Approximately 19 individuals entered the cadet chapel and while inside placed plastic bags containing pig's blood and ketchup on the altar. Upon leaving the chapel, members of the group handed out inflammatory literature. After disregarding repeated requests to desist, 15 were detained and issued orders expelling them from the academy. There had been a request earlier from the, no, actually that goes later. This is mandatory chapel, and so as you heard from Will, they changed the requirements for mandatory chapel during this time period from 71 through 74. You had voluntary chapel by the end of that period, but at this time it was still mandatory. So in November, members of the clergy and laity concerned, which was an organization of local people as well as Denver people, requested to talk to cadets, and General Clark turned that down. And so on the 14th of November, 1971, approximately 100 members of the CLC entered the cadet chapel and stood throughout the service, blocking the view of members of the congregation. Others in the group left the chapel during the service at 5-minute intervals. These people were scattered throughout the congregation, and their behavior was conspicuous and disruptive of the service. No action was taken against them for this conduct. However, when the congregation had dispersed, 32 individuals were detained for distribution of incitive literature. They were identified, issued letters of expulsion, and released. Two individuals were detained. These were Barbara Miner and Ann Guilfoyle, who had participated in the May demonstration. And there were complaints filed against them. Again, on 21st November 1971, 15 members of the clergy and laity concerned entered the cadet chapel. Again, they stood throughout the service. Although we considered this behavior annoying and discourteous, we ignored them and took no action. Then on 12th November 1971, an incident occurred that required a severe adjustment to our approach towards the actions of these individuals. A special chapel service was held at the Community Center Chapel. The theme of this service was Concerned Hope and Prayer for POW/MIA, and the guest lay speaker was Mrs. Joan Pollard, Colorado Coordinator for the National League of the POW/MIA. Approximately 25 wives and children of the POW MIA were present. About 10 minutes before the service began, seven members of the CLC entered the chapel and stood in the second pew. They basically disrupted the service. At the end of the service, they wanted to talk to the chaplain. He asked them to wait in his office. They remained at his side talking to him. Their behavior was in complete disregard of his religious office. As a parting gesture, one member of this group left a smeared handprint of ketchup on the front of the chapel. Bob Browning, who was chaplain at the time but who did not witness this, said it was red paint. If anybody knows anything about red paint or ketchup, I'd like to know, because I haven't found an eyewitness to what went on. And so the demonstrations continued in January. They continued in May. At that point, there were 15 protesters arrested, one of them being Mr. Saltzman. And then in November, there were further arrests. That was the anniversary of the last year's demonstration. And so people who had received letters of expulsion, and this was done in the Catholic chapel, this is the Catholic chapel, put letters on the altar documenting their letters of expulsion. And I have a excerpt from an interview of General Clark. This was done by Jim Gaston for the 50th anniversary of the Air Force Academy. And so he's talking about what happened.
I wanted to add, I think I told you about some of the confusion that existed here on the Air Force Academy as a result of troublemakers about the firebombing at our quarters. I failed to mention they tried to blow up our officers' club. And I was awake, lying awake in bed at 6 o'clock in the morning when I heard the thump. It was big. But of course I couldn't tell where it was, and I had to decide whether to call somebody or wait till they called me. So I waited till they called me, and it was a while, because they finally decided it was at the Oak Club, and they went up there and found three big fir trees down and a dumpster torn all to pieces, and a panel truck torn to pieces, and all the glass gone from the club. But that's all the damage they did. They put it in a dumpster, and there was another dumpster between it and the club. And so that's all the damage they got out of that. But that's the kind of stuff was going on. And I'm not sure I mentioned, but there was a large group of clergy who felt that we were responsible for the continuing war. Army was out of it, just the Navy and the Air Force. And they were causing us a lot of trouble. They were trying to spill pig's blood on the altar during services on Sundays. And we were hauling their bodies out of the chapels bodily and putting them in the paddy wagon and taking them away Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. And we prosecuted them and won our case, lost it at the appeals level. But from then on, they were not authorized to intrude on services and interrupt anything. But they were authorized to demonstrate in areas where normally were public to people, like outside the chapel and outside the stadiums. But it was a very difficult time, and it went on for months and months. Took a lot of fun out of things.
And so the protests actually continued, and as General Clark mentioned, the appeals court overturned the convictions of the demonstrators. And so then there's kind of a really interesting interlude, I guess, where General Clark and Mal Wakin, General Wakin, who is the head of the philosophy department at the time, met with some of the concerned clergy and laity against the war, and they then created a, compromise? Was it a compromise? Where they became guest lecturers in an ethics course, and that went on for several years. Although what General Wakin explained was one day he was away from the academy, and the Associated Press made a huge press release, front page, with a photograph of one of the CLC participants. And because it was put on front pages of many newspapers, including the Washington Post, he said he then had to answer something like 19 congressionals for having anti-war people teaching in my department. It was very difficult to explain that it was a one-hour lecture once a semester, and they were there to represent the pacifist position. But that, unfortunately, basically stopped that whole program. One of the things that General Clark said to me is, well, I guess my tenure will largely be remembered because of the influence of the Vietnam War. And I'm the archivist, so we have cadets. We had one cadet last semester who actually did write a paper on the anti-war demonstrations and what was going on at the academy during the Vietnam War. But I wanted to end on a note saying I think General Clark's legacy really is not the Vietnam War situation, but more race relations. He put Benjamin Davis on the General Davis on the Board of Visitors in 1971. He's the third standing on the from the right, and he created a Black Culture Festival that was not only at the Academy but also downtown, He also is the person that created the committees that made it possible to have women at the Air Force Academy. This was pretty reluctant. General Clark was a straight arrow, but he gave a welcoming speech to these ladies, and he says, among other things, I personally hope that we won't reach the denigrating point when we ask our women to fight our wars for us, too. This, I think, is against nature and not supported by the overwhelming but silent majority of women. Further, we are already, according to some, a matriarchy. it's like, really? But as in many cases, he kind of swallowed hard and said, okay, this is going to happen. And so it did happen. There are women at the Air Force Academy, and life goes on, I guess, is a good way to wrap it up. So thanks. I did talk to a bunch of people to try to figure out, what was going on with red paint versus blood versus ketchup, and never really got a lot of straight answers, but I really appreciate everybody who was there and talked to me. So thank you.
Our final presenter today will be Mary Sprunger Fraze. She earned a BA in English from Goshen College, Indiana. She's lived in Colorado Springs since 1979, when she and her spouse, Peter, joined the Bijou community, a faith-based, intentional community serving the poor and attempting to live nonviolently. Mary directed and performed with the First Strike Theater from 1990 to 2002, has taught adults in ESL classes for the last 13 years and is currently for the Adult Literacy Program of the Pikes Peak Library District and worked as a teaching assistant to Professor Stephen Handen at the Colorado College from 2009 to 2012. She's grateful for Anabaptist moorings, Catholic worker connections, and all dissenters of conscience past and present. Mary.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to the Library District for this opportunity and for including dissent in the many military matters of the Pikes Peak region. Today I highlight a few stories. Most of the stories of resistance to space warfare in Colorado Springs have not been highlighted by the mainstream media, but the few that I will show today were. There would be hundreds of stories, but we will have a few. March 23, 1983, the president calls for a shield in space to intercept nuclear missiles. April 1983, MILSTAR, a next-generation satellite system, will be controlled from Space Command. NORAD Public Affairs Officer Kay Cormier says, quote, "We are preparing all of our systems so they could survive nuclear war." She adds, "Space is a hostile environment." Colorado Springs is not a hostile environment for CSOC, the Consolidated Space Operations Center that Congressman Ken Kramer lobbies for. May 1983, officials break ground for the Consolidated Space Operations Center. Before their five-minute ceremony, protesters hold a prayer service on site. Sister Marie Nord states, "This is wrong. This is the next generation of war making." As officials leave, the protesters plant flowers in the May snow. One tries to plant his feet and is grounded. It's 1986. The president comes to town. He's the man with the plan. "Come on, gather round." But there are leaflets in hand with a small vocal band, and the pie they decry cannot satisfy. Marie Antoinette has come to say, "Let them eat pie in the sky, SDI." While the lady and her crew are frisked and detained, on the president's parade, one must not rain. In 1987, Colorado Springs activists form CPAS, Citizens for Peace in Space. Here you can read their goals. Bill Salzman coordinates CPAS with Sister Marie Nord. They announce a national demonstration. Colorado has $751 billion in SDI contracts. Half of the Colorado companies contracted are in Colorado Springs. Nord says, whether SDI works or doesn't work, the vultures, high-tech companies, stand around waiting for contracts. Salzman adds, economics are a major driving force. The poster for the national demonstration. In the fine print, it says, "Join us to register a firm no to Star Wars and other plans to militarize space. Let's reaffirm the ABM treaty and keep the serenity of space for peaceful purposes." It's the largest anti-SDI gathering in Colorado Springs. After the rally, 200 people caravan to Falcon Air Force Station. Spokesman there, Bill Baugh, says it's the largest demonstration ever at the satellite tracking station. The next day, protesters enter Peterson Air Force Base with the same anti-SDI message. Air Force spokesman Major Bruce Lewis says that though protesters abused the right of free speech and interfered with the base, officials decided to give warnings instead of citations because there was no violence. 1 year later, 1989, another rally is announced. And this poster says, "Stop the militarization of space. Is it too late? Mindless greed destroyed the grasslands, forests, the majestic bison of the Western frontier. Will we now allow the military exploitation of space to consume our resources, bleed our spirits, and end our species? And the day before the rally, the natives return. A CEPAS press statement explains, today, May 5, 2 1-year-old American bison, one male and one female, were released at Falcon Air Force Base, which is to be their new home. This action is the first step in a process to convert Falcon Air Force Base back to the same prairie grassland it was 6 years ago. It is possible that some of the facilities can be converted for use as a center for studying the ways of peace and environmental responsibility. The statement ends with an offer of temporary water and hay to get the herd started, along with a willingness to consult with base authorities about the proper care and handling of their new wildlife. A Falcon official calls the action inhumane. You see the quote on the screen, Lieutenant Colonel Dietrich. They can protest what they want, but they don't have to use animals to do it. 10 Falcon and Humane Society employees take over two hours to capture the buffalo. Mother and King, named for Mother Jones and MLK, are taken to the Humane Society. Bob Jackson snags the Gazette's front page and later their photo of the year with his capture of the chase. KKTV's crew is escorted off base after filming the release and having the photographer's camera seized. Two bison detained, a camera detained, and the protesters free to return another day. In fact, the next day, after 300 people rally in Monument Valley Park, 100 of them caravan to Falcon, where 16 climb fences and cross police lines to scatter buffalo grass seed. Mother and King escape auction when a rancher takes them to greener pastures, where their stay of execution makes for many happy days before they meet their maker in a burger joint. 6 months later, three CEPAS envoys visit Falcon again, this time not with bison, but with citizens' arrest warrants. Here's their warrant for Colonel Thomas Lieb, and what it basically says is that they want to arrest him for crimes against international law and against treaties that the United States is a party to. And they name the treaties here, the Hague Conventions, the Nuremberg Principles, the Geneva Convention, and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972. So that they say that the activities at the National Test Bed violate these treaties and international law. The three envoys are arrested before they are able to arrest. The next day's article announces tighter security at the base. One of the three did gain entry after giving her name and showing ID. She said she needed to deliver official documents and was allowed to proceed. SDI spokesperson Rob McKinney states, mistakes were made, but procedures have already been changed. All visitors will now be escorted. Here you see a quote by the other two who did not gain entry as after they were sentenced for trespass. Sulzman also invited Judge Peter Booth to investigate significantly unlawful activities are going on a regular basis at Falcon Air Force Base, he claims. 6 years later, six people attempt to hand deliver a letter to General Joseph Ashy, commending general of the U.S. Space Command. This is after they have submitted various letters asking him to reply, and he has not replied. Here's the list of the six people who entered the base with their letter and the purpose for their letter. One of the six, Susan Gordon, is mother to a 3-year-old and 6 months pregnant at the time of this action. She's the woman in the foreground. Well, these people are also convicted. One is not sentenced because he has a family emergency and is given a deferment. But the judge, Briggle, rules that the content of their letter to the general and their intentions are irrelevant. Thus, their testimony is not allowed. The case is only about trespassing. What the court stops short, the indie covers. The six get front page as makers and shovers. Malcolm Howard's article includes the protesters' plea, don't militarize space. Treaties of 1967 make a haven of the heavens. Malcolm also quotes retired Space Command General Charles Horner. To keep the military out of space is unrealistic. After all, the military was first in space. Space isn't sacrosanct. Perhaps it should be, but it's too late. The horse is already out of the barn. 12 years after the first attempt at a citizen's arrest, three more people again attempt a citizen's arrest, this time for General Ralph Eberhardt of Air Force Space Command. This warrant charges criminal acts under international rules of war, breaking treaties as in the previous warrant. It also adds the cease and desist order for all personnel to stand down from any orders concerning the launching of the 550 nuclear-armed missiles in Colorado and four other states. One of the envoys explains her action here. And again, these peace activists are convicted because, and their judge is accused of muzzling them because he also says it is only a case of trespass. They will not be allowed to talk about their motivation or what they were carrying. Their attorney, Walter Garash, erupts. To do that is to muzzle and deny due process of law. This is insane. The jury doesn't hear any argument about international law, their motivation, or the content of their document. So the jury returns a guilty verdict within 45 minutes. Some supporters of the defendants put duct tape over their mouths to protest the judge's gag order. My open house is your open house? A decade of debate and dissent. This is in the 1980s at Peterson. Peterson Air Force Base invited the public to its annual Armed Forces Day celebrations. Kids in cockpits prompted activists to leaflet this open house that was held every year. This is the leaflet they offered to children. It might be fun to play war and pretend to shoot a machine gun or fly a bomber, but it's important to remember that war is not a game. It's not fun to be killed or to watch as your mother, father, brothers, and sisters die. That's what happens during a war. When those big, shiny planes drop bombs in the movies, it's exciting. But in real life, there are real people where the bombs fall, and they are ripped apart by the explosion. During World War II, our country made and dropped a bomb on Japan that killed 70,000 people. Now, 30 years later, people are still sick and dying because of that one bomb. We need to study ways of solving problems without killing people and destroying their homes. It's not easy, but it's possible. The leaflet offered to adults began, "Who says war is hell? In Colorado Springs, it's a carnival." The leaflet continues to describe the entertainment, balloons, and rides in cockpits that children are offered. And it claims, how we teach children about war is more important than what we teach them. Well, the leafleters had been detained several years in a row for passing out the literature. Finally, they asked for an injunction, and a judge granted them a preliminary injunction against the Air Force in order to have their right to distribute literature during the Armed Forces Day open house. Thanks to the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the sixth leaflet, the 30th anniversary of NORAD, from a site chosen by the Air Force at the open house day. And we see July 1988, U.S. District Judge Mache rules that open house is a public forum. He condemns the Air Force for, quote, content-based discrimination, which is intolerable under the First Amendment, unquote. He says protesters can hand out anti-war literature because at the open house, military contractors offer brochures, nonprofits solicit volunteers, the Catholic Herald displays newspapers, and Bibles inscribed, presented by the Air Force, are distributed. The protesters must be subject to reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. Protesters question the reasonableness of Air Force restrictions the next open house when they're assigned an area between porta potties and dumpsters. After moving into an area accessible to open house visitors, they are once again detained. And once again, the kid checks out a cockpit, this time one from the F-16. June 1989, eight protesters are again detained as the Thunderbirds wow kids on their dad's shoulders. Finally, in 1990, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals overturns Judge Mache's ruling saying the base is not a public forum. The court rules that the Air Force does not permit anyone on base to convey political or ideological messages, even at open house. Peterson changes the name of the celebration to Air and Space Day, and the term open house is never reinstated. A decade later, five visitors take hammers to a fighter jet and satellite receiver at Peterson's air show. They are detained. And soon, local sisters organize a decade of resistance. Each year, on the Friday nearest the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki, Catholic sisters lead mothers, brothers, and others in a day beginning with a shared meal, followed by a prayer service, and then a vigil at Peterson Air Force Base. The sisters pray big for an end to war. The founder of Sisters Witness, Sister Barbara Huber, asserts, "We're the most powerful nation in the world. We're the richest nation in the world. We could set the example." Some years, sisters and friends cross the line to commit civil disobedience, to pray, to invite the general to become a conscientious objector. Three pilgrims head to the base chapel for more prayer. Sister Barbara carries the sign. The three are arrested just over the line. Their sign is seized and reassigned. Sister Barbara finally agrees to speak at the 10th Sister's Witness. She encourages, "Let's continue to hold our beautiful, battered world and all that inhabits it in prayer and action. Courage." Dissent has employed symbolic intrusions, civil disobedience, exercising First Amendment rights, arresting generals, public prayer walks. It continues today. This ends with 2011, but many undocumented actions have happened, as I said, and continue today. As protesters oppose Army expansion in Pinyon Canyon, the killer drones coming to Fort Carson, and the increasing militarization of a society whose fabric rests on what they say is a military, industrial, religious, educational, media complex. Persistent, insistent, and resistant, these people hold banners that say, "The heavens are for wonder, not for warfare. Arms race in space? Heavens no." The resistors keep coming, and perhaps they hear the sisters who keep singing. "Well, bless my soul, we're on a roll to heaven's door. Da-do-run, run, run, da-do-run, run. A new world's here, let go of fear, we're stopping war. Da-do-run, run, run, da-do-run, run. Yes, heaven's door. Yes, we're stopping war. Up against the bombs and guns. We got the nuns, we got the nuns. We'll carry on and on, we'll carry on." Thank you.
At last, we do have time for some questions, and I'm going to throw a curveball and ask that all of our presenters come up and be available for questions, whether you talk this morning or whether you talk this afternoon. Mr. Kreider will be able to accommodate him. So come on up here. And while they're coming up here, I'll put in a plug for next year. The theme next year is Myths and Mysteries of the Pikes Peak Region. So put it on your calendar. The process here will be, you'll ask a question, I'll repeat it. They'll shove each other aside to get over to that microphone. And let's have a round of applause as long as they're all up here. I haven't corralled Heather here. So. Okay, question. Yes, ma'am. What was the court case that ruled there was blood on the altar? Mary Elizabeth? Go over to the... Mary Elizabeth, can you use the microphone, please?
There was never a court case about blood on the altar, and I have not gotten anything clear on what was there, whether it was red paint. I have a lot of people who said it was red paint. That congressional inquiry response is the place that I found the ketchup and pig's blood reference. I've seen ketchup. If anybody was there, I would like to know. The court case was whether the base was open or closed, and whether people were allowed to go into the chapel or outside of the chapel. And the ultimate ruling was that since people came to visit the chapel and the football games, that those were open, considered open, and therefore there was no trespassing. So that was a court case that was resolved in 1973. And there's been a lot of open and closed base discussion, especially lately, if any of you tried to get into a graduation a couple of weeks ago and had to wait 2 hours for getting through the gate, there's just a lot of checking that has been going on as far as right now the Air Force Academy has parts of the base that are open and parts of the base that are closed. But that's where the court cases are. It's on access.
Another question? Yes, ma'am. The question is for Mr. Kreider, and it is, what was the process that a person becoming a conscientious objector went through, in particular in his case?
Well, there was the draft legislation of the autumn of 1940 calling for all ages up to 36 or so to register, and I received orders to have a physical examination. I was at the University of Chicago then, took that exam, and I had a low number, and in the summer of 1941, I received instructions from my Selective Service Board in Newton, Kansas, that I was drafted. I was accepted as a conscientious objector and given 4E status. And I think my number was about 300, which was in the lower 20%. And so later that summer, I was drafted to go to Colorado Springs.
I saw another hand out here. Yes, sir. There, he recalls a plaque recognizing the aviation efforts on the peak, and wonders from Eric whether that plaque is still there or not.
It has been removed. It wasn't stolen, I don't believe. I've never seen it. There have been a number of things placed on the summit of the peak that have been removed. Perhaps one of the most dramatic was a fighter jet that was hard stand up there for a while, and it was an attractive nuisance, and it was removed. But yes. Did that answer your question?
No, you don't know what happened
last year. I don't know. I do not know what happened to it.
Over here, question? There seems to be, besides aliens in space, illegal objects. And he's asking Rick what those might be.
The policy set by President Dwight Eisenhower in 1955, that's 2 years before anything was ever launched, was that we would have, the United States, a policy of peaceful uses of outer space. We therefore have never put a weapon in space. I don't know why people believe that there are weapons in space. But let me clarify something. This business of terminology is very important. Space has been militarized since 1959-60. And it's not just because the United States put military satellites up there. The Soviet Union did it. When other nations were able to do it, they did it. China has done it. So the militarization of space is very old, and it's as old as our activities in space. Weaponization of space is a different term. The only nation that I'm aware of to date that has ever put an orbital weapon in space is the Soviet Union, and they did it back in the 1960s. Now, the other thing that's going on right now that's very dangerous is the use of suborbital weapons that go into space to take out a satellite in low Earth orbit. And we have done that. The Soviet Union / Russians have done it. And most recently, the Chinese did it. And they destroyed one of their own satellites by doing it. And in the process, created over 2,000 pieces of additional space debris that we, Space Command, had to put into the catalog and track. And a lot of that material is still up there. The other thing that's very dangerous about space, and it is a dangerous environment, not because it's weaponized, but because things like that happen. When we say that we're tracking 22,000 objects, we can only track things that are over 10 centimeters. About like that. So we track explosive bolts that come off of the payload fairings when you launch a satellite. And this isn't just military, any satellite. You have these explosive bolts that are floating around in orbit, and they're going over 17,000 miles an hour. That's a lot of kinetic energy. We even track an astronaut's glove that one of our astronauts lost back in the 1960s. And if something like that, a mere glove, were to impact the International Space Station, it would endanger the lives of all of our people, international residents, who are up there and doing scientific experiments. So, you know, it's a dangerous place. It is becoming more dangerous, primarily at this point, because of what China is doing. They are trying, through laser technology and various kinds of anti-satellite weapons, to go after satellites that are 22,000 miles up there in orbit. And these aren't just our military satellites. These are the satellites that you use to watch television, that you use to communicate if you have friends halfway around the world. And so increasingly what, and we're doing this right now, Space Command is, we're looking at putting in our Joint Space Operations Center out in Vandenberg, Air Force Base in California, commercial representatives, civilian people who are flying commercial satellites, and they will sit side by side with the military people, because increasingly, it's sort of like the Federal Aviation Administration. Space is becoming so crowded that if we don't do this, we're going to have some really catastrophic accidents up there.
So what you're saying is, except for you, I wouldn't be watching CSI and CSI and CSI and CSI.
No, I'm not saying
CSI.
That.
Okay.
But I am saying.
We have to end it, Rick. We have to end it.
I am saying that there, you know, there are increasing problems with the use of space right now, and it's not just because of a military presence or the militarization of space.
Okay, one more round of applause for our presenters. And keep your hands up there, because now I'm going to turn it over to Tim. He always thanks other people, but nobody ever thanks Tim. So yay, Tim.
You may be seated. What a great day. Thank you so much for attending. I'd like to thank Mike for his great MC skills. So we're trying to persuade him to do this next year. Please. So what do you say, Mike? I'm putting you on the spot. That's okay. Okay. There's several people I'd like to thank, and I'll make it really brief. I'd like to thank Chris Nickel, of course. She's the organizer of this. Without Chris's exceptional organizational skills, this wouldn't be accomplished. And then also the enthusiasm of all of the Special Collections staff really make this a successful event. And that includes Dennis Daly, who runs the AV equipment and did the lunch logistics. So all of the staff, thank you. And Dory, who I think just stepped out, she was a volunteer timekeeper. Oh, there she is. Hi, Dory. She's our volunteer timekeeper. She keeps us on task, and that really makes a good experience. So good job, Dory. Thank you. And then I'd like to thank the video production staff, who are led by Jamie Hastings, who's behind that wall in that little booth. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you. You were great today. You were troopers. You soldiered on. Despite the many snafus. I have a word that I created some years ago that's similar to snafu. It's a word, it's compounding two words. It's compounding dysfunctional and normal, and it's pronounced dysfunct-normal. I use this frequently, and I want you all to say it together, dysfunct-normal. Now, I've learned that if I get more than 200 people to use my word, it'll be in the dictionary. So. We hope to see you next year, and thank you for coming this year.